We're thrilled to announce that the Buddhist Geeks community is now open to the public. The community is a space for you to connect, practice, and learn with fellow Buddhist geeks in a new kind of cloud-based sangha. The community is comprised of three elements. First, BGTV, a members-only video channel with expert-level teachings and conversations on topics of interest for hardcore geeks. Second are BG Hangouts, real-time, member-led groups that are designed to facilitate peer exploration. And finally, Open Practice, online spaces for you to sit with others wherever you are. We invite you to participate in this newly forming community, our Sangha in the Cloud. You can learn more at BuddhistGeeks.com/community. Buddhist Geeks, discover the emerging face of Buddhism. Episode 304, Zen Predator. We're joined this week by New York Times columnist Mark Oppenheimer to discuss his recent book, The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side, and the decades of sexual scandal surrounding Japanese Zen teacher Eido Shimano. Buddhist Geeks is supported largely by the generosity of our listeners. If you like what we're doing, please consider making a one-time or monthly recurring donation by visiting BuddhistGeeks.com/donate. Hello, Buddhist Geeks. This is Vincent Horn, and I'm joined today with our special guest, Mark Oppenheimer. Mark, awesome to have you on the show, and thanks for taking time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, you've written a really awesome, I guess it's being called a Kindle single. So it's like a book, but it's also like a long article.
The Kindle has a, Amazon Kindle has a marketplace for stuff that's, you know, between like 10 and 100 pages. So it's shorter than a book, but longer than most magazine articles, sort of novella length, and they're priced to sell, and they are a bit shorter, so, and they're called singles. So this is like, you know, it's 55 pages, so it's like a long magazine article is what it is.
Nice. And the title is The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side.
The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side.
Which is a great title. And I'd say even better is the cover art for this thing. If you can see it here in the video, it's a Zen Enso with a little red snake wrapped around it. So highly provocative. And we're going to get into the content of that. I want to mention, too, you're most well-known, I think, for your biweekly column on the New York Times, where you explore all kinds of stuff related to religion, primarily in America or globally?
Yeah, primarily in America. I have done pieces from England. I think I might have done a piece from Canada once. But, yeah, it's for the national section, so it's primarily all over America, all different religions all over America. Mm-hmm. If people have good story ideas, drop me a line. It's called Beliefs, and you can go to, if you go to the Times and search, enter keyword beliefs, you'll pull up all my columns. And it's really whatever is intriguing or interesting about religion, not necessarily current events, not something that happened yesterday, but some quirky little corner of American religion. This ebook, in fact, got its start as a beliefs column in 2010.
Yep.
About Eido Shimano being forced out of the Zen Study Society in New York City. And then it grew from there because more stuff kept coming out and people kept calling me and feeding me information. People really wanted the story to get out there. His sangha was really divided, and a lot of people really decided it was time to break this out into the open. So it started as a short column, but then it clearly grew beyond that pretty quickly.
And from what I remember, that column was pretty instrumental in causing some actual structural shifts in that organization. So in some sense, it sort of broke open this whole issue.
I think that's right. I mean, when my column ran, he was going to be on a kind of phased retirement, and he was going to be out like within a year. And Roko Sherry Chayat was going to take over as the abbot on a sort of graduated slow schedule. And I think the idea was that he would have a year in which he would be feted at there'd be lots of nice dinners and sangha gatherings, and he would be given a kind of dignified retirement. And after my article ran, it sped up pretty quickly, and people realized that it was not appropriate, given that he was being forced out for being a kind of unrepentant harasser, groper, and some would say abuser of women. It was not appropriate to treat this as a kind of the retirement of an honored leader that he really had to move, and that he had to move out quickly, that the longer he stuck around, the more members they would lose. So things sped up to the point where I think my piece ran in August, and I think he was supposedly formally gone by December, and now is not supposed to be on ZSS property without without a chaperone or something like that.
Okay. I'm curious, since, you're in this business of writing about religion, and sometimes your articles no doubt have real world ramifications right. for those communities, how do you kind of respond to situations like this, where it actually has these big kind of impacts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't set out to have impact, right? I mean, I set out to tell a story honestly and thoughtfully and fairly. It would be mistaken to decide, okay, how can I write this to have the most impact or to force real world change? Of course, it is the case that everything we do in this world, including writing articles in the New York Times, but not limited to that, right, has real world impact, right? Like something will change in the world because of this live webcast that you and I are doing, right? Somebody will ignore his daughter for 5 minutes, and as a 3-year-old, she'll remember and hold it over him tonight at bedtime and say, "Daddy, you were supposed to like read me," So everything has effects, and I've gotten used to that. I think that it requires that I try even harder to be fair. When I used to work for an alt weekly, I used to be the editor of the New Haven Advocate, which was the alternative weekly in New Haven, sort of the Village Voice, SF Weekly, style paper, LA Weekly, The Stranger in Seattle, all those kind of scrappy newsprinty alt weeklies. There we were out to be kind of scurrilous and rascally. And now But people treated us as like the disobedient child in the corner, the redheaded stepchild who's right. always acting out. When you're writing for a place like this, people take everything I say almost too seriously. And I have to be doubly scrupulous because, people lose jobs. There was one case where I'm pretty certain that I destroyed a Christian intentional community, a kind of commune, through my journalism. We could talk about that if you're curious, but it's pretty heavy sometimes.
Yeah, well, I do want to explore some of the parallels, when we get into the details between what you're reporting on here with Ado Shimano and also with sort of the Christian tradition.
Sure.
But first, I wondered, for those people who aren't so familiar with the details of this case, the details of the situation. And I have to admit, I was among those people until I read your bite-sized morsel of reporting goodness. And it's pretty startling in a way that this is he an 83-year-old?
Yeah, I think he's 83 teacher? Now. Yeah.
Yeah, that and he's, young compared to Joshu Sasaki Roshi, who
who's 106.
Right. So we've got these kind of first generation Japanese Zen teachers who migrated to the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s even. And it's pretty startling, like the kinds of stuff that you're reporting on as having happened not just once or twice or three times, but like repeatedly for decades. I wonder if you could share a bit of the story and the details.
Let me give you the 2-minute version. And just to your point there that, of the, one person I quote in the book, a longtime monk, said to me, of the four most important teachers to come over in the 1960s from Japan, in the Japanese Zen tradition, three of them themselves caused major sex scandals, and the fourth, his successor did. His successor being Richard, Richard Baker Roshi in San Francisco. So, the number I've arrived at is probably out of the 3 or 4 dozen most populated and important and influential Zen centers in the United States, a quarter of those easily have been touched by sexual misdeeds on the part of a major teacher at those centers. So, percentage-wise, like it's a small sample size, but percentage-wise, it's really, really bad.
It's huge.
For Japanese Zen in America, and not so much better for, other Buddhist strains necessarily. The 2-minute version is that Robert Aitken, the great Hawaii Roshi, was a prisoner of war in Japan in the 1940s. He came back. He learned about Zen from his Japanese captors. He came back to Hawaii, started what eventually became the Diamond Sangha, and then, 15 years later, early 1960s, he wants to bring over some Japanese monks for more teaching, more learning. Somebody recommends Ado Shimano. Shimano comes, he takes some classes at the University of Hawaii, he sits with people, does Zazen, pretty quickly begins sleeping with women. And there's strong reason to believe that two women he slept with ended up having mental breakdowns. Their doctor, interestingly, was Linus Pauling Jr., the son of the Nobel Prize winning chemist Linus Pauling, which is interesting, a Nobel Peace Prize winner as well. And so pretty quickly, Bob Aitken realizes, holy cow, I have to get this guy off the island. And he sort of banishes him. Shimano flees pretty quickly. Within a few months, he's in Manhattan. This is New Year's Eve, 1964. And here's the crux, right? Like, here's where we get to, in a sense, the fulcrum of the story only 3 years in, which is that Aitken at that point could have told people, this guy is not to be trusted. He's really, really sleazy. And instead, and we have notes that I've seen, that Aitken writes, you know, something to the effect of, like, we can't let people know because they'll hold it against Zen Buddhism and it will harm the practice of Zen, it will harm the spread of the Dharma. And so he covers it up. I mean, he figures, okay, it's New York City's problem now. Shimano gets to New York City. He pretty quickly is handed the keys to the Zen Study Society, which D.T. Suzuki had founded, but Suzuki was back in Japan. And all of a sudden, he has like the number one Zen center in New York, which was had almost nobody sitting. But then he's very charismatic. He quickly finds donors. He's given a lot of money. He buys a beautiful townhouse on the Upper East Side. In the early 1970s, he builds Daibosatsu, which is his build, you know, from scratch. He builds this large monastery in the Catskills. And meanwhile, you know, he continues taking students and just serially sleeping with them. Some are willing participants and would say that they were not harmed by the experience and maybe even helped, although I didn't meet any who said they were helped. But I met some who said, oh, it wasn't so terrible. All the way, you know, the best case scenario is not so terrible, all the way to being hit on by him or groped by him or pressured for sex by him, completely destroyed my Zen practice. And also harmed my ability to feel close to people ever since.
And how many people did you end up speaking with?
I spoke to about a dozen who had had unpleasant sexual encounters with him. Everything from highly coerced intercourse or oral sex to just they'd been groped or grabbed to, you know, verbal pressure that they resisted. But that's like a dozen whom I found without digging too hard who were willing to talk to me, or at least whom I managed to get on the phone. Okay, so when people have estimated for me that there were many dozens more, since we're talking about like a 50-year period, that to me sounds very reasonable. Like for legal reasons, I'm not going to name a number, but you're talking. I mean, I know one person who said it's got to be 200. Well, you know, I don't know, but I do know there are whole episodes where people left the sangha and said, "I'm sick of this. Like he just can't keep it in his pants," and presumably this was after three or four women had, you know, come forward, and I don't even know who those three or four women are. So like there's various moments where like that must have been four or five women. That must have been four or five of them, and we don't even know who they all are. So it was really an extraordinary, you know, and he would, and I'll just, you know, just to wrap up, like that's basically the story. It finally all comes crashing down in 2010 when his board finally takes action, and subsequent boards had sort of promised to force him out, but every time he would kind of talk them down off the ledge and he would stay, and he would make these promises, and the promises would be things like, well, I'll stop all the, or they would be things like, well, I mean, he once promised Dennis Kelly that it was, you know, a Roshi in mm-hmm. Minnesota, I think now, right? He once promised Jinpo, he said, I'll only sleep with Japanese women because they don't tell. So sometimes it would be, don't sleep with these liberated Western women because they can't keep their mouths shut. So the level of misogyny that's going on in and perpetrated by him in the sangha really becomes deeply profound, and yet nobody can see a way out because they revere him. His board, you know, he has this handpicked board. ZSS is a nonprofit. The people who can fire him are his board members. His board members are all his devoted students.
Right.
So there's this kind of closed circle of abuse that just can't be broken.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, and to see, you know, detail after detail, kind of highlighting this, it's hard to ignore the profoundly dysfunctional nature of that pattern and the way that it caused clearly a ton of harm. I mean, you were talking about whole cadres of people coming into the Zen Center and then many of them leaving because of issues surrounding this, and then new ones coming in. I mean, that's
new ones coming in, and people, you know, people realizing that they've been there 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden they're like senior monks, and they're saying, "Well, why am I senior? Where is the person with 12 years or 15 years experience sitting with him?" And they would realize, well, that whole flight of people, that whole cohort left after some scandal or another. I mean, they talked about, it was like well-known terms. Can I use blue language on this podcast?
Go for it.
Okay, so you know, they talked about the Fuck Follies, and then there was Fuck Follies Part 2. You know, and each one was a way of describing a different episode in the 1970s when, you know, all of a sudden it came out that he was sleeping with more than one person. There were, you know, he'd be sleeping with a woman and then with her roommate or like, you know, her best friend or the woman who was sleeping in the room next door to her or what. Meanwhile, keep in mind, he's married and nobody knows what his wife, his Japanese wife who lives in the United States with him, thinks of all this. And then, you know, the dysfunction forced on some of these women where they feel that if they are to, you know, one woman wrote, I don't want to tell people because then it becomes, if I stop other women from joining, then it becomes even more of an old boys club. So there's this cruel paradox where if they speak out, they feel that women will be afraid of joining the Sangha, rightfully so, but then it'll be an all male Sangha. So it'll reinscribe the patriarchy they're trying to fight against. So essentially you're supposed to keep your mouth, as a woman, you feel I should keep my mouth shut because I want, the only way to break down the sexism is to attract more women. But if I talk about what happened to me, I'll scare off the women. So better to keep my mouth shut and hope that they don't have, that they'll join. And then I guess not go through what I went through. It's just very disturbing.
Yeah, so there's that piece. And then the other piece you mentioned, which is this sort of fear of talking about it because it'll somehow hurt Japanese Zen, you know, in America. And presumably, and this gets to the kind of paradox that in some ways is at the heart of these sort of things, which is, you know, how is it, and I don't think this is true of just Zen, how is it that these, you know, charismatic religious leaders who clearly are having some sort of positive impact on their congregations, because otherwise, why would people care if Japanese Zen was hurt? They're clearly getting some benefit from it, even though they're either on the direct receiving end of this sort of stuff or they're seeing it peripherally. So that gets really at this paradox of like, what is it that keeps people from talking about this stuff? And why is it so perpetually happening in
things like this? One thing you have about Japanese Zen, and of course, you know, you're part of a movement to kind of decenter the notion of the guru, right? I mean,
sure.
And one thing about Japanese Zen is it's very guru-centered historically. And, you know, the whole idea of Dharma transmission, the whole idea that, you know, you're sitting with Shimano Roshi, who sat with, gosh, I just wrote a book about him, and I'm forgetting the name of the guy who gave him Dharma transmission. But, you know, Soen Nakagawa, right? So he sat with Soen Roshi, and Soen sat with so-and-so. And, you know,
and is so-and-so an actual Zen master?
So-and-so, probably. So-and-so.
So-and-so Roshi?
So-and-so. But Soen Roshi was a real dude. And the idea that you're sitting with someone who sat with him, very, very important in Zen Buddhism and in Japanese Zen. And so people, you know, the choice that a lot of people felt that they were facing was either sweep this under the rug, pretend it didn't happen or just minimize it, or lose my practice, right? Like there was not a strong sense that you could go to someone else for a strong practice. Now, in part, this is because they did revere him as a teacher and a lot of people felt they'd grown tremendously in their practice with him. In part, it's because this was their sangha, right? This was their community of people whom they had attached to. In many cases, they'd given up a lot, you know, people who had made career choices so as to have to free up money and time to, you know, do zazen with this sangha often, you know, to do sessions, to go away for 90 days, 3 years, whatever. And, you know, in one case, one woman who left her child for months on end, I mean, her young daughter, it's just like really, so once you're in that deep, the idea that you would then tear down the teacher who brought you there and what, you know, then it's all for naught. And then you've lost your practice. And it's, what is interesting to me is, you know, Roman Catholics don't tend to think, well, if I lose Father Joe, I'll lose my Catholic practice. Yes. And Jews tend not to think if we lose, you know, Rabbi Shmuel, then, you know, I'll lose my Jewish practice. But a lot of these people felt that Shimano Roshi was their practice. And that without him, they'd lose Buddhism.
Okay. Yes. And that goes to the heart of the guru student model, you know, where the teacher really is in some sense a pivotal part of the training.
That's right.
Okay, and we've explored that kind of ad nauseum in a way on the show, and it seems like, and what's really interesting, you know, you mentioned in your interview with Robert Wright, talking about the book, that you know, also you've heard a lot of Tibetan Buddhist communities talking about how there's a similar kind of situation going on there. And what's interesting is the kind of strain or school of practice that I've spent the most time in, immersed in, is the insight meditation tradition, which comes out of Southeast Asia and the Theravada Buddhist tradition. And it's largely, I was just thinking about this, I've only literally heard over the last decade plus of one rumor of someone sleeping with a student in a way that was unethical and caused problems in the community. And that's of hundreds of teachers. So I was thinking about how is it that this strand is different? And one of the main differences is that there were no old school Asian teachers who were part of founding those communities. They were founded by young Westerners who ended up instituting a lot of different kinds of safeguards against stuff like this.
Oh, I think that's right. And I mean, Zen has a particular history. You know, so Tibetan Buddhism largely came into the United States, right, in a different path altogether, a third path altogether, right, which is Dalai Lama worship coming through like Richard Gere and the Beastie Boys, right? So, you know, and to some extent, Robert Thurman and people like that, and, you know, so that's another path, right? Zen has a particular history, which is it has been imported by highly revered Japanese-born guru types who then begin to create a clerical class, for lack of a better word, right, a teacher class of Native American teachers. But, you know, you had these Japanese teachers coming. A lot of them came in the 1960s at the height of the sexual revolution, at the height of a kind of credulity or naivete about the perfectionism or the hyper-spirituality of Eastern religion, right? A sense that like Easterners can do no wrong. Like while we're bombing, you know, Southeast Asia, the Southeast Asians are just people of peace and they're bringing us, you know, these peaceful traditions. So there was just a kind of naivete and a kind of willing suspension of disbelief about East Asian and Southeast Asian spirituality at the moment that Japanese Zen teachers are coming over and setting up these communities. So, you know, women in particular, sure, and men would go to these communities because they felt damaged by Judeo-Christianity, because they had sexual abuse in their past. And they would think, you know who can heal me? A Zen teacher can heal me. So, and they would put themselves in this incredibly vulnerable place. Now, you know, were people like Shimano Roshi deliberately taking advantage of that kind of vulnerability? I mean, that's a separate question, but it is a history peculiar to how Zen came to this country that is not shared by, say, the Insight tradition or the Tibetan tradition.
And whether it was deliberate or not, I mean, it is what happened.
It is what happened. You know, it's also the fact that there's no hierarchy. Now, in some communities, you know, people will say, well, in the Catholic Church, hierarchy was a problem because it was the hierarchy that moved priests from one parish to another and kept it quiet. But then there are people in the Zen tradition saying, well, the problem is there is no hierarchy. So whom do you complain to, right? I mean, if you're Western oriented, if you're from the Insight tradition, if you're the Insight Meditation Center, right? And you have a board, the sense of a board of directors and fiduciary responsibility is very Western, right?
Yep.
And they take it really seriously. But yeah, I don't know how seriously the board of directors of, you know, the Zen Study Society. I mean, Shimano was on it. So was his wife. His wife was the treasurer for a while. I mean, there's all these conflicts of interest that they just don't care about because that's not what they're about. They're about creating a space in which Shimano Roshi can teach. It's a whole different mentality.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think the hierarchy thing is interesting because clearly the Zen teaching and the kind of you know, what you're aiming for is a sort of some sort of recognition that is beyond sort of this and that and upper and lower and all of that. So that I think that's what you mean by a lack of hierarchy. But clearly there's a hierarchy within the organization. I mean, there's the
right. I just meant a sort of organizational hierarchy.
Right.
That,
right.
That you know, at least if you're more Western oriented in your organization,
right?
You probably have people running the finances who aren't the wife of the head teacher.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, to the credit of, I think, most Buddhist centers, but not as true in the Zen Studies Society in New York.
Yeah, I mean, you know, since all of these scandals have been kind of coming to light again in a way, because what's interesting is they've been coming to light, you know, in the last few years. I've just seen one after another, especially from the Zen tradition. And in each case, like, most of the people were repeated, you know, abusers or predators. You went even so far to say that Shimano is a sociopath. And I wonder, what you're...
Someone else asked me about that word, and I think, you know, maybe I shouldn't have used it. I mean, there's a very rich debate in psychology and neuropsychology and about whether such a thing exists. I think the concept, and I should say I'm not schooled on the concept, I remember learning a lot about it from Dave Cullen's book on Columbine, because I think it's his argument that one of the Columbine shooters is, quote, a sociopath. And then there are people who took him to task saying that's actually, you know, that's a narrative construct. There's no actual medical evidence that some people are sociopaths. The idea is that some people don't really have a sense of, that a sociopath would be someone without a sense of right and wrong. And therefore, I think, without a conscience. So, you know, most of us, when we do wrong, even if we do it again and again and again, and we can't help ourselves, we understand what it is that's wrong about it. And some part of our conscience is pricked, right? Like we, you know, we have reckonings, even if we silence them and push them aside. And I think the idea about a sociopath is that, you know, like Hannibal Lecter, whose pulse doesn't go up when he chews off a person's face, right? He's totally chill about it because he just has no sense that he's doing anything wrong in Silence of the Lambs. So, you know, I don't think Shimano Roshi has chewed off anyone's face. I suspect his pulse would go up if he did. I think that what I shouldn't have used a clinical term. You know, what I should have said is he seems to have created a personal narrative whereby this isn't a problem. Like serial womanizing is just not a problem. It's, you know, he told me that he thinks in some cases sex with your teacher could be helpful and help you on your path to enlightenment. So he's obviously told himself, I think that some percentage of the women fall into that category where he's helped them. His typical habit when it turned out badly and a woman was very, very distraught was that she was mentally ill or she was disturbed. All of his accusers, it's sort of their problem. In one case, he told me that one man who accused him of all sorts of malfeasance, well, his problem was that he was a homosexual. He said that to me.
So
he's pretty old world.
Old school stuff.
He's a pretty old school guy. Yeah. He keeps it very old school, feudalist, samurai era real. So, you know, is he a sociopath? I probably shouldn't have used a clinical term. But I do think that he has a personal psychology in which he's doing good some of the time, not so much harm a lot of the time. And basically, he is who he is. And if people have a problem with it, that's their problem. So he's kind of walled off any sense of culpability for the people whom he hurts.
Yeah, it's interesting when you say walled off and you talk about the kind of feudalist mentality. I mean, in some ways, when I look at the situation and similar ones to it, it's like we've got these old school, some of them actually grew up in feudal Japan.
Right.
You know, Sasaki Roshi. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, the early 1900s.
Like the emperor was actually divine for him in his era. Right.
Right. And I mean, I know a lot of kind of the situation is us sort of taking, you know, 21st century Western ethics and sort of in looking at their behaviors through that lens, which is appropriate because that's where they live.
Right.
And yet, one of the things I noticed that's a little strange is that oftentimes it seems like we sort of assume that just because they're here, that somehow they're going, you know, somehow they're going to understand the basis for those ethics.
They'll absorb Western ethics. I mean, right. So, and there's all sorts of reasons they wouldn't. I mean, for one thing, when they were brought here in the 60s or when they came here, people were telling them, Americans were telling them left and right, thank God you've arrived because we've lost all sense of morality as a society. We're involved in war in Japan. We, you know, Judeo-Christianity is morally bankrupt. Like, you're here to teach, to bring us, you know, ethical behavior and honor. And so they were told, like, thank God for you, right? So that's number one, is their initial experience, which carried on for a couple decades anyway, was of being told, like, they were going to save the corrupt West with their more profound spirituality. So that's number one. Number two, like all revered people, they end up living in a cocoon where the people who they interact with day in and day out are their most loyal students, the ones who have risen up to be vice abbot or whatever, you know, maybe a spouse, the long-term resident monks at the monastery or wherever. you know, people who are immediately disenchanted just leave, right? Like if you or I stepped into Zen Study Society and heard some of the whispers about what was going on, and if presumably we're ethical people and we think that sounds shady, we just say, well, I'm going to, you know, we show up twice and then we leave and we just, it wouldn't be our problem. So the people who stick around and end up becoming close enough that they have his ear are also likely to be the people who tell him what he wants to hear and who are very, very deeply loyal.
And when you talk about a cocoon, you know, in some sense, a cocoon can be, you know, from a practitioner's point of view, can be a really positive thing,
yeah,
because you've got this very strong container in which to kind of focus, right, single-pointedly focus on a particular, you know, developmental task. And yet within that cocoon, if it's a Japanese medieval, you know, whatever, you know,
yeah,
what else is permissible?
No, I mean,
there?
It would be really interesting to do some sort of comparative work and say, like, how do the ethics of, you know, cloistered Catholic monks and nuns develop, right? When you have this radically disengaged, you know, from when your spirituality is so radically disengaged from the outer world, you know, how do you maintain some sort of ethical grounding? It seems to have worked very, very badly. I guess the answer is, you know, for him, you don't. You have to, if you're going to be isolated in that cocoon, right, then, I mean, part of the problem, too, is in America, you know, as someone pointed out to me, and I quote him in this piece, you have this class of practitioners who are neither lifetime devotees, they're not professional monks, like in Japan, nor are they one-time students who come for the weekend, right? They're sort of like serious amateurs. They're in, they're out, they do a few months, but then they have to go back to practice law for a while or attend to their family, but then they do a session, but then, right? How responsible is that class of people, Vincent, for taking care of themselves in a sort of cocoon-like setting where all the rest of society seems to fall away, right? I mean, if they end up sleeping with the Roshi, it's an interesting question what they can be expected to know or not know.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, you can say, well, they're constantly in contact with, you know, society. Like, they know the norms. On the other hand, they've dipped out for 3 months specifically to cocoon themselves in a different set of norms.
Yes.
Now, in Japan, they didn't have that class of people. That's a, like, American 60s invention, is the sort of, like just spiritually seeking, on the go, all the time Buddhist.
Yep.
And it's new. And we haven't figured out, like, what, how to ethically contain that person, or how to ethically help and support that person, I think.
You know, I found it interesting too. You talked a little bit about the parallels that you've seen in the fundamentalist Christian communities, and especially around experiences of conversion.
Right.
And I was curious, yeah, if you could say a little bit about that sort of parallel. Because, you know, here are all these people leaving Judeo-Christian roots and basically going into a kind of similar situation, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I mean, again, I want to be so clear about Japanese Zen here, because I think it's not this way. I mean, if you go into, like, Tibetan Buddhism, I think you're basically going into, you know, a kind of old school Roman Catholicism where you have a pope, and the pope is the Dalai Lama, in a sense.
It's even more feudal, arguably, than Japanese Zen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, interesting. But, you know, I'll restrict myself to Japanese Zen, right?
Sure.
In America. I think the comparison I drew was that, like the evangelical who is converted not by sort of a process of discernment, but like in an ecstatic revival tent, right? Like the people who just, they show up at a camp meeting, they fall, and when the minister says, like, are you ready to give yourself over to Christ? The music is playing. The people all around you are sort of putting their arms on you and hugging you, and it's, tears are flowing. People are confessing their sins. You've been drinking too much. Your wife just left you. You're in a broken place. You just decide, I'm going to fall to my knees. You run up to the altar, fall to your knees, spread your arms. You ask to be baptized, right? You come in this ecstatic moment. And that ecstasy holds you for a while. And then maybe over a year or two or three, you begin to apply some reason, and you begin to look, you know, have a little more discernment about the community you've chosen. And maybe you decide, well, this ain't for me. And the next time you're in a camp meeting or a revival tent or just a revival in a church building, it doesn't do anything for you. And you realize, wow, 3 years ago, this, like, it seemed like Jesus was in the room, and now I've kind of lost it. I guess the analogy I was drawing is, like, for a lot of people, that first encounter with someone like Shimano Roshi or that first weekend retreat is totally transformative. It's like, at last, this thing they didn't even know they were looking for. And then the disenchantment comes and I look at him and say, I can't believe I ever fell for that guy. And so much of it, I guess, just has to do with where you are in your life at the moment you find that minister, that reverend, that priest, that Roshi.
And it's so interesting too, because, you know, from the insider practitioner perspective, and I know you're writing this from an outsider perspective, which gives you a unique, you know, vantage.
Right.
You know, all of the models that I'm familiar with also talk about disenchantment as part of the spiritual process. So yeah, they have their own models to explain and also to figure out how to remedy those disenchanted things. But it complicates things, because there may, you know, I think the argument can be made, there may be some legitimate truth to those claims.
Right.
But they only make sense when you're in the cocoon.
Right. Well, what's so interesting about you're telling me that certain paths see disenchantment as part of the process,
yes,
is it speaks particularly badly then of what happened with Shimano students, where the disenchantment frequently led to like extraordinary mental anguish and separation from the Sangha. Right. Like it, mm-hmm, you know, it seemed rarely to help people along their path or to sort of enrich their journey. And it seemed to always be just a, like a profoundly disruptive thing without any redeeming side to it. So that's really, I think, speaks very badly to his teaching.
I would have to agree with that. And I don't think that point is really a defense against that kind of behavior, because I think there are plenty of examples of communities where people go through periods of disillusionment that are kind of important parts of kind of letting go of certain even ideals about what the teacher is, you know, and like perfection ideals, right, for instance.
I mean, look, I just wrote a column about John Yoder, who is a famous Mennonite. He's the most famous American Mennonite ever, and probably the most important American pacifist theologian ever. And it turns out that he was really sleazy when it came to women. I mean, really Shimano-like in his predations. And he had a very weird theology about why it was okay to sleep naked. Like Gandhi, by the way, he thought it was okay to sleep naked with women you weren't married to test your own resolve, so long as you didn't have intercourse with them. Really like creepy, weird stuff. But Yoder, this is only coming out. It's not only coming out now, but they're really, he died, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And the American Mennonite community is really reckoning with it right now. And part of the reason it was so hard for them to is because he was in a sense their pope. I mean, he's the greatest American Mennonite and the one who helped think through their opposition to war, which is so central to their identity. And they're going through a process of maturity, of realizing this man was not a saint. Like what you were talking about, where there's a kind of growth that has to happen where you give up this idealization of the teacher or of the path or whatever. And you realize it's in this world and it's flawed and it's difficult and it's hard and it's not perfect. And the Mennonites they kind of thought Yoder was perfect. And then they realize he's like the least perfect guy there is. And so there's a real kind of maturation as a community that comes with that sort of reckoning.
Nice, nice. No, I think that's a great point. And I know your intention isn't to have an impact on the world, but I think, you know, when you're writing about this stuff, for the people that are familiar with those communities or practicing in Zen, I mean, I think it helps catalyze that kind of reckoning. I mean, that I don't see how it couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, well, one hopes, right? I'm not sure. The Zen Studies Society, just as a coda, I should say, is like caught up in a bad lawsuit and counter lawsuit with Shimano. He's suing because he wants his pension, of all things. He wants them to keep paying him. He hasn't moved out of the apartment that they bought for him in the 1970s. So it's gotten pretty ugly. And from what I hear, the society has fallen on hard times financially. A lot of the wealthiest students actually have followed him out. There's a community, particularly of men, middle-aged men, who really embrace him still, and some women, and are supporting him and have yanked their money from ZSS. A lot of this is hearsay and rumor. A lot of people won't talk on the record. The lawsuit is supposedly going to arbitration soon. Hopefully it'll never end up in court. But it's, you know, that particular community, this has been very disruptive to, and hopefully they'll heal, but it's going to be a process.
Mm. Cool. Thanks, Mark, for taking the time to explore this with the Buddhist Geeks. And for everyone who's interested in checking more out, definitely would recommend the Zen Predator of the Upper East Side. And if you're practicing within the Zen tradition in particular, you know, educate yourself well before entering these communities where there's a closed circle system going on.